right, so welcome to the first episode of the Necromaniacs podcast. This is Mike Hill, and I'm here with Mike Scandato.
Hello, everybody.
For any of you who may have tuned in to the first Everything Went Black podcast, it was me and Mike.
Yeah.
Kind of kicking it off over at the, whatever that diner was there on Fifth Avenue. Daisy's Diner.
Yes, that's right.
After watching the Serbian film.
Yeah, wow, that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Two and a half years ago. Oh.
So it's kind of like, you know, maybe a continuation of that kind of thing, since we're going to be talking...
Movies.
Movies, horror movies, comics, right. Like just, you know...
Mm-hmm. Yes, you decided to keep Everything Went Black more to music, I guess.
Yeah, music and, like, you know, art and, right. You know, other kind of stuff like that. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But, so we just finished watching the fine movie called Here Comes the Devil. And that's a film by Adrian Garcia Bogliano, who was originally from Argentina, then relocated to Mexico. And Here Comes the Devil came out last year in 2012.
Right.
So.
It's just kind of making, I guess, the rounds here now. It had played at festivals and stuff. And we actually watched it on iTunes. It's going to be coming out on Magnet on DVD. But a lot of independent horror movies, it seems, are taking this route where they're coming out first, you know, online, so to speak, or, you know, different ways to view it rather than just coming out straight on DVD. So this is one of those movies, and I think it's actually a great thing. It helps build, you know, build some buzz, you know, and lay some groundwork.
So he's got like 9 other films out.
Yes, this is it's pretty amazing. In the new issue of Rue Morgue magazine, the Canadian Horror Bible magazine, as I like to call it. They do a really big, lengthy interview with Bogliano, and aside from the interview, there's a 2-page spread on everything he's done. He's done some movies with his brother, too, actually, Ramiro Bogliano, and they've been making movies since their teens, basically, late teens, and several of them are coming out through Synapse in America. One is called No More Sola, which translates into You'll Never Die Alone, which is coming out through Synapse later this year. Another one coming out through Synapse is called Massacre Esta Noche, which it says translates, according to Rue Morgue, Watch Them Die. And a third one, which, let's see. Well, actually, it says those two are coming out through Synapse. There is another one out now that you can rent called Cold Sweat, which is available through E1 and Dark Sky. And the more recent one, prior to Here Comes the Devil, is called Penumbra, which is available on Amazon Instant Video and on DVD from IFC. IFC is also has a lot of hands in the horror genre as well, as we'll get into later with the Maniac remake, which is through IFC.
Yeah. So, basically, the story is about a young couple, Felix and Sol. And, you know, they go out on, it looks like they're on a vacation somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not, it's made clear that they're not from that part of Mexico. They're
right.
traveling from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And their two children, Sarah and Adolfo, which is an interesting name for a young man,
mm-hmm.
venture out on their own, and they disappear overnight into this mysterious hilltop. You know, there's a cave.
Cave, yes.
And then there's, you know, some of the locals warn them that no one goes up there. And, you know, there's some sort of demonic spirits inhabiting, you know, and one particular guy is like the, you know, the 7-Eleven clerk there.
Which, of course, they learn after they've gone up there not to go up there because this is a horror movie. So, hey.
Yeah. So I think this, we're not going to avoid spoilers in this one. So. You know, we just go for it, man.
Yeah, I was wondering what exactly how much we were going to give away, but you know, it's kind of important to discuss it. I mean, giving spoilers it's kind of impossible to not do them, I guess.
Yeah, because I mean, the whole thing sort of, you know, wraps up, and you're just like, oh wow, okay.
Right, and this definitely leaves it open to interpretation as to what, you know. what happened, so to speak. It's one of those movies. I mean, it's not, it's somewhat reminiscent of Blair Witch in its moments. Not with the ending. Don't get me wrong. The ending is definitely a little more clear cut. But there's this supernatural, mysterious angle to it. Absolutely, you know.
Also, some of the, I would say, clarity. Lack of clarity in some of the instances reminds me a little bit of Dario Argento's films.
Right.
You know, so there's a little bit of that Argento, 70s, devil movie kind of vibe to it, Possession.
Yes, yes. It definitely has some of the 70s vibe and atmosphere, but it's a little more of a less hokey and more of a darker movie. Than some of the more, over-the-top satanic stuff of the 70s, barring, The Exorcist and The Omen. It doesn't go the hokey route of, Satan's cheerleaders or something like that. It's definitely more of a straight horror movie in that sense.
And it's also pretty extreme with the violence, too.
It's bloody. There's a fantastic scene quarter midway through the movie where someone gets what you refer to as a Colombian necktie, so to speak. Or is it, in this case, a Mexican necktie. Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's not forget the opening of the film. First of all, the film opens with like a straight up, it felt like it was like 10 minutes long, like lesbian scene.
Yeah.
You know, they just go right into it, right off the bat. Just like bang.
Two girls going at it. Definitely more than you would see in the average, say, American rated R movie. I think it was definitely more, more of explicit in nature.
Yeah, the movie in general has a lot more nudity than you would see in an American, Hollywood type of film, There's a lot of, freedom down there in South America.
Yes, they're not afraid of sex or violence, down there.
So, there you go. Sex and violence. We got it all in this film. So, after the lesbian scene, we get into the story of the young couple. They're on vacation. They have these two lovely kids. There's a sort of hint that their love life may not be what all Felix, the husband, is hoping for.
Right.
So with the sort of the idea of getting away and getting into some intimacy, they allow their kids to wander off, and this is kind of the one of the cruxes of the
right.
film.
Right, give us some time to be alone and, go do your thing kind of, moment.
Yeah. So the kids wander off, and the mother gives them, the daughter her watch. It says you have an hour and a half.
Hour and a half, yep.
And then you come back. We go back to the hotel or whatever. So, the guy Felix bangs out his wife. Or actually, he just fingers her in the front of the car.
Yes, there's, I have to say, probably some of the most intense and intimate husband-wife sex in a movie I've seen in a while.
Yeah.
Usually it's reserved for the non-husband and wife. But, it's very, very interesting, explicit, and, dirty isn't the right word. It was kind of just intense kind of husband and wife sexual moment there.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing I like to comment on, too, is how, the women are very attractive, yet they're not that sort of ripped,
yeah,
gym-toned.
They're a believable husband and wife, whereas a lot of times in the major big money horror movies, you get a supermodel husband and wife.
Yeah, you got the dude takes his shirt off, he's got abs.
Exactly. Yes.
So
very realistic.
It's very realistic. They look like people you run into in the street, which gave it an air of realism, that sort of verite like vibe to it.
Yes.
So they doze off, and when they wake up, they realize that it's several hours later. The sun was low in the sky, and their kids were nowhere to be seen.
Mm.
Okay, so they start panicking a little bit. Okay, they start waiting around. It's dark, and still the kids are not there. So ultimately, the police get involved, and this one of the most crooked looking cops I've seen shows up on the scene.
Smarmy cop, yes.
Yeah, he shows up
with a bolero on, and he's dressed very kind of ancient for a modern movie. But then again, who knows what the police dress like down there? But very, very odd looking, yes.
So he sends him to the hotel. Says tomorrow's gonna be a long day. You better get some rest. and the police will remain at the convenience store awaiting the children's return.
Right, near the cave.
Yeah, near the cave, at the foot of the cave. So they go back to the hotel. They have an argument because, you know, everyone's very tense. They're both
right.
very tense
Kids
about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Kids are missing. You know, they're blaming each other.
Right.
You know, it's your fault. Like, you never give it up. So, like, you know, I'm tense all the time.
You don't
like
want to do anything with the kids, she tells them.
Yeah, you're always busy, all that kind of stuff. So they find the kids the next day. The cops come back with the kids in tow. And the kids are somehow different.
Right.
Changed.
Quieter.
Yeah.
More, they even, you know, the facial expressions are even a little different from the two kind of, you know, happy-go-lucky kind of kids you see at the beginning of the movie.
Lifeless, if
right.
you will.
Lifeless is the word they use, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, the story unfolds, and it turns out that, you know, the children actually, you know, this is the big reveal here.
Right. Something went down at the cave, basically.
Something went down at the cave.
The kids aren't right. There's teachers at school are noticing that they're different and they're just not as outgoing, but they've also noticed this very strong bond between the two of them.
Yeah.
It wasn't always there initially at first. They are kind of inseparable now.
Yeah, they're inseparable. And so, you know, they bring the kids over to the doctor to get examined, and it turns out that the girl child. Hmm. You know, there's evidence that she may have been sexually abused.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, that there's some sort of sexual activity that has, you know, has gone on.
Right, according to the doctor.
According to the doctor.
Examiner. Right.
Yeah. So, as a result of that, you know, they get suspicious. The mother gets very concerned. You know, of course, you know, I mean, you know, it's understandable.
Any parent would, right.
You know, any parent would. So, the children, as part of their sort of analysis of the therapist, they drew these drawings of the what happened and what transpired over the last 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And the one common thing between both drawings is this mysterious van or truck.
Red truck, right.
Yeah. Now, originally, the mother thought that, that it was a picture of their car.
Which happens to be red.
Happens to be red. And the father indicates that, well, no, this isn't at our vehicle at all. It's a vehicle that he actually saw at the hill.
Right, and you, the viewer, we see it as well.
Yeah.
It's like this truck.
Yeah, it's like an ice cream truck or
right.
something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So it turns out that this creeper, Lucio, is the guy who drives this truck.
Mm-hmm.
So,
who, in essence, pretty much looks like someone who might molest a young girl.
But, yeah, he looks like a molester.
But looks can be deceiving in this movie, as they say. The thing is, one little thing we're leaving out about Lucio is a little bit earlier on, he is caught kind of checking out the daughter and wife in a rest stop bathroom near the cave because the girl happens to have her period on for the first time in her life, and, you know, her pants turn red, and, you know, it's she has her little moment with her mom, and, you know, they go into the restroom, but the creeper is kind of witnessing all of this.
Yeah, they see him, and they see this guy, like, looking at him through the mirror.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's, like, greasy-haired.
Yes, and the bathroom doors in Mexico, women's rooms, are wide open, apparently. They guess, because it was a very interesting scene where she's looking in a mirror, and the door is wide open, and the creeper guy's checking them out in the bathroom. So that was kind of funny.
So conclusions are jumped.
Okay? By the parents, yes.
By the parents, and they believe that Lucio is you know, behind this, you know, sexual abuse of their daughter, and you know maybe even the son too,
right? Abducting the kids, possibly.
Yeah,
right.
So they track this guy down to his trailer, and, you know, in the cover of the night, they break into his living place and wake him up in the middle of the night, demand that he tell them the truth about what happened that night.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is, up until now, is that the parents seem very normal and very nonviolent and very, I mean, it was very surprising to even just see them decide to go up and do this, actually. You know, they turn into these revenge-bent, you know, crazy people in a way.
So, you know, the mother wants to know, you know, where it is, like the missing underwear.
Missing underwear, right? Yes, like, correct. You know,
they found the daughter's underwear with, you know, blood on the crotch and whatnot.
From the menstrual strain.
From the menstrual, the menses.
Menses stains. Yeah, something we don't know anything about, but yeah. Hey, you know.
And they end up slitting the guy's throat and giving him this, like, really, in a very, very graphic, one of the more brutal throat slitting scenes,
yes,
I've seen ever.
Definitely.
Transpires in this film. The only throat, you know, slitting scene that comes close to that is this throat slitting scene in VH1.
Yes.
Yeah.
In the first one with the young couple, yeah, where it's just kind of really close up and just very, like, in your face.
Yeah, it's
almost,
like,
almost real looking. Almost
very,
you know,
brutal. But yeah, this is, I would say, more so because she reaches in and pulls his trachea,
yes,
out.
Yes, the husband slices the man's neck. And the wife, in her, you know, pent-up nuttiness, grabs in there. I just,
yeah,
whoa, it's
it wasn't
so
enough.
Unexpected. Right.
It wasn't enough that this guy's throat slit. She had to, like, take it to another level,
yes,
and rip his,
exactly,
trachea out.
Because, you know, here they're certain that this man molested their daughter.
Yeah. So, you know, as the film progressed, you know, you would think, okay, that's the end of the movie. You know, they found the rapist and,
right,
he's dead, you know.
It's still pretty early on in the movie.
But, of course, now the supernatural element starts to,
yes,
take hold. And we see that the kids are actually, you know, there's something more afoot, you know, as opposed to having some sort of traumatic response to being abducted and, you know, raped or whatever.
And we have to add that there was a babysitter watching the two children while the parents went out and did their murder. And, you know, because the kids haven't been at school, you know, since what happened to them and everything, and they've been staying home a lot, so they have a babysitter come over to watch them while they go out and do their thing. But another thing to add is there's definitely a theme of sex and of blood and just almost like this supernatural kind of thing where we see that the husband and wife, after they've done their horrible thing, in the shower together, naked again, you know, with blood all over their bodies. And they have sex several times in the movie,
yeah,
which there's this, you know, definitely a theme of, like, sex and violence.
But also, it's, I think that one of the things, too, is not necessarily, yeah, definitely sex and violence, but, you know, similar to early slasher films, you know, where the sex, like, you get killed as a result of having sex in a, mm-hmm, lot of those early movies. I feel like the sort of irresponsibility is actually what they're referencing as opposed, mm, to actual sex. Because it's,
right,
like, you know, the parents were a little remiss in their parental, you know, duties by, you know, allowing the kids to run away while they, you know, they finger each other
in
and pass out in a parking,
right,
lot of a, you know, whatever, like,
mm-hmm,
a,
yes,
convenience,
yes,
store, you know. And then this other, you know, caper that they went on to go and slit this guy's throat. You know, as a result of that, you know, there's more problems at,
yes,
the household.
That, yeah, very true, very true.
You know, so
it's almost like, yeah, it's like the sex, there's no good outcome. There's not, bad things are going to happen, even with a married couple.
Yeah. Mm. So, you know, things start going a little crazy after that. You know, the
house lights go on and off. There are these, like, the house shakes, and there's a scene where the mother walks in and the young boy's levitating.
Yeah.
And the girl has these, like, you know, nightmares, and there's just all sorts of nothing but bad stuff going,
yeah,
on.
So you're run-of-the-mill possession.
Yes,
you know,
yes,
all the signs of possession are in place, you know,
mm-hmm,
and so that's, you know, essentially what you take away from that is that they're possessed by some...
The two children, right.
Demonic, malevolent spirit is,
mm-hmm,
you know, somehow inhabiting their bodies and causing all these things. So during this night of murder and, you know, bloodshed, one of their friends, you know, a good friend of the family, is watching the children. And when they come back to the house, she's gone, right?
Kids are asleep.
She's, mm-hmm, gone. So the next day they track her down and she's at the house, you know, upset, obviously. You know, comes to the door and is very resistant, very reluctant to tell the mother what happened,
yeah,
the night.
And
before,
she looks like a mess herself, the babysitter, another beautiful young woman in the movie. Clearly, something happened to her as well.
I don't think there has. I think that all the female characters have been naked in the movie too.
Yes, yes, that is true. You know, gotta love South America. Hey, you know, they don't mind these things though, there, yeah. Mike. No.
Except for, you know, the obviously underage girl is not naked in the
Yes, that is true. There are implied things with the children, but nothing is shown.
Yeah. So, one of the things that's implied is actually confirmed by the babysitter.
By the babysitter, correct.
Yeah. So, when they finally brace her up, the babysitter goes into this, you know, feverish description of what happened the night before. And a lot of, you know, this whole flashback scene is told very, very 70s, very psychedelic, you know, there's a lot of colors,
Baby-ish.
Rosemary's Babies,
yes.
You know.
Absolutely.
Like she remembers these details as if they were in a dream.
And, right, like flashing lights and screams, and she is inexplicably naked, and she hears these noises. She gets up naked from the couch while she's telling the story. And she goes upstairs, and she hears these moans and screams, and lo and behold, she opens the door to one of the children's bedrooms, and it's the two children going at it, the brother and sister, in the room. Again, they do not show this. They show her expression on her face as she sees it is what they show.
Yeah, you know, it's described, but not shown, which is, you know, might be a little bit too much for
exactly,
some people.
Yes.
It would be too much for me, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
So at that point, you know, the mother is freaked out.
Uh-huh.
The father's a little distant still.
Yeah, she's keeping certain things from him. And after the babysitter has finished telling her tale, the mother, and I guess in desperation, is like, well, maybe it was a nightmare. And she goes, no, you know, it wasn't a nightmare. And she opens up her shirt to show these large prints on her chest, because throughout the story, she's talking about how she felt someone, the devil, standing on her chest, which is something I've never actually heard in a movie before. Like, you know, it's kind of cool and interesting. And there are these nasty prints on her chest, and that's indeed what it looks like.
Yeah. So, the mother goes back to the hill, into the cave,
and to see what the hell happened over here.
To get to the bottom.
Because now she's thinking, we killed this guy, and we may have killed him for no reason. He might not have done anything, exactly, except steal panties from the daughter. So she goes back, and you know, she sees these strange things outside the cave, these candles and antlers and occult looking items. definitely the 70s-esque in that respect. But she's in the cave and she's looking around and she basically sees where this ditch area inside the cave, and we see the bodies of her two children in the ditch of the cave.
Decomposing.
Yes. And the boy is shirtless.
Yep.
And the girl, I believe, is her head is bruised. And you know, the viewer at this point is like, well, what? You know, the kids are in the house. You know, how are the kids dead in the cave? You know.
So, and this is the point where there's some implication, but it's not actually spelled out. And I think you and I both agree as to what we think happened at this point.
Right.
All right, we think that the the two kids go up to the cave, and the boy, Adolfo, has tries to rape his sister, basically.
Yes, however, we must flash back again. See, there's all these little seeds planted here in the movie. The boy is kind of bugged out by the fact that his sister is bleeding for the first time. And the dad explains to the boy while the wife and daughter are in the rest stop bathroom a little bit about the birds and bees, right?
Yeah, he kind of.
And he's about two years younger than his sister.
Yeah, I'd say he's a little younger. Yeah.
Right. Saying that women bleed once a month for a very long time, and except for when they're pregnant. And he's like, really? Like, he's just
fascinated.
Right. He is fascinated by all this and by, you know, I guess the female body. And so there's a little bit of that kind of planted in his head, I think, about sexuality and women.
Yeah, so, you know, he goes to, you know, maybe get experimental with his sister.
Yes, but as a result of the cave, I'm going to say the cave, I think, is where the demonic entity resides. And those who stumble upon it become the victim of it.
Basically. Well, there's also that one guy who's like the 7-Eleven convenience store clerk who... He just appears and sort of lays down these like gems of knowledge on people.
Yes,
you know, he seems to know like what's going on. First, you know, he describes that you know, this hill, you know, has, it's said that there's been beings living there,
right,
under the ground since the beginning of time, which is a very Lovecraftian sort of idea. Uh-huh. You know, there's these ancient beings,
yeah, mm-hmm.
and they just manifest the weak.
He's right.
Explicitly, yes. Said the weak.
The weak, that's true.
And he looks at humans as empty shells, essentially. Mm-hmm. So the two kids, you know, they're young. You know, they're maybe
virgins.
You know,
right.
Virgins. Mm-hmm. They're not as, their spirits aren't maybe as strong as, say, adults are.
Exactly.
So these entities embody them. They manifest their bodies. And I think, you know, without fully, it maybe wasn't a full possession at first.
Right.
But it might have brought up some of the baser instincts.
To me, it's possession, but it's more like almost like a body snatcher kind of thing.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's not right. It's somebody else. I guess,
right.
You know what I'm saying? It's clearly, you know, your body is dead. You're dead. There's somebody else in your body,
right.
taking over.
But I think what has to happen, though, is that the creatures don't actually kill the human.
Mm.
You know, there's some sort of human interaction that causes the death, and then
yes.
the creatures manifest.
Correct.
So I think that, you know, whatever essence or, you know, force that exists inside that hill, when someone of a weaker spirit goes there,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm not saying they're like, you know, a weak person, but they might be not, maybe, you know, the case of the children, not fully developed.
Right.
You know. So this energy senses that, and these like baser instincts might rise up in them. Hence,
mm-hmm.
you know, the young man who his father had recently laid out the mysteries of the female body, you know, on
mm-hmm.
him.
Right.
You know, that growing instinct might have taken over, and he tried to move on his sister.
Exactly.
And then there's a flashback where she, you know, we show the sister falling, and she hits her head and dies.
Right.
But
something missing, yes. They, and I brought this up when the movie was over. We don't see what happens to the boy at all. Michael has seen the movie twice at this point. I've mm-hmm. only seen it once. I will see it again. I did not recall how the boy wound up, you know, being killed, so to speak.
Yeah.
And that's definitely a bit mysterious. But yeah, I mean, right now the movie, what makes it so good, I think, is that it's kind of a mix of a couple of different parts of the horror tree in one. You know,
yeah,
you have the possession, and you have like a supernatural, and you have also something that has just like a lot of, you know, violence and sex in it, because.
Yeah. Big time.
Some possession movies don't really have any of that in them. They're just possession movies. But at the same time, it has, you know, it's a modern movie. It takes place now, and you know, it you can see that, you know, it, stylistically. But I just think the mood and the atmosphere brings to mind, you know, older movies.
Yeah, it's very creepy, very unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of. So the thing that reminds me of Argento is there's sort of just like these shots of people standing there,
mm-hmm.
you know, with like an expression on their face.
Right. And the interesting use of metal music in
yeah.
several points in the movie. We were not able to figure out who the bands were. I mean, it could be any number of South American bands. But, yeah, obviously the director wanted some aggressive music in the movie at times, and it actually fits kind of, you know, nicely, I think.
But I'm really interested to see like what happens as a result of this, because you know, Here Comes the Devil was on the cover of Rue Morgue, and mm-hmm. you know, Rue Morgue's a pretty, you know, high profile magazine right. in the horror world.
And I tell you one thing, they put High Tension on the cover of their magazine before anyone did, and that went on to be a huge movie. They've, I mean, they've taken chances with movies they think these are going to be big horror movies. Inside was on the cover.
Yep. Martyrs.
Martyrs. All of the really big buzz indie to slightly bigger horror movies of each year are usually covered in Rue Morgue before they get big.
Yeah, like innovators in the
exactly.
genre.
Exactly. I mean, that's they have that on lockdown, I feel like. So for them to give it a cover and to give exposure to all these other very interesting movies that Bogliano has in the pipeline that America is going to see now, me and Mike were saying how we are very interested in seeing what he's going to do next.
Yeah, because, I mean, the film is definitely a low-budget film. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that by any means that it's
cheap looking.
Negative. That's
right,
not a negative statement at all. Mm-hmm. It's not cheap. It's very professionally shot. Everything's very intentional, like with those zoom ins mm-hmm. and everything. You know, the acting is great. You know, the story's great. But I'd be really interested to see in this, in America at least, how he catches on, because you know, mm-hmm. like you mentioned, you know, they, Rue Morgue seems to be a couple steps ahead of the rest of the population.
Yes,
like
definitely.
What's happening? You know, what's
yeah, they usually pick winners. And the other cool thing is that, like, you know, Fangoria magazine, which in my opinion has gotten better under the new regime over there.
It went through a dark period, though.
Yes, no, absolutely, absolutely. It was almost unreadable for a little while.
Yeah.
but they seem to play catch up often, I think, with Rue Morgue, and then sometimes they'll do things, you know, that Rue Morgue won't do and whatnot, but. Yeah, I feel like we will probably see another cover feature for this movie elsewhere, but Rue Morgue will have been the one to do it first.
Yeah. But yeah, I give it a thumbs up, man, for
sure.
Oh,
no, absolutely. I mean, yeah. I mean, I would recommend this to any of my friends or people I know that like horror movies or, you know, off the beaten path horror movies. I don't know if the average mainstream, you know, Walking Dead fan would love this movie, but I think any horror fan that has been in tune with what's been going on in the last 10-15 years
yeah.
would like it, and people who are like me and Mike who are enjoying these seven, not necessarily grindhousey, but 70s-esque vibe movies, I think will enjoy this movie.
Yeah, the pace is a little slower, which
yes.
I think is typical of most films from the 70s. I
mm-hmm.
think that, like, these days, action happens so quickly.
Right.
Like, and I'm not even just talking about horror films. Talk about in general. The plot moves so quickly. Everything happens so fast.
Mm-hmm.
And the 70s and those films, you know, from that era, the plots develop slower and there's a little bit more of a build-up. And that's typical to the way this whole movie progressed, I think.
No, totally. I mean, yeah, I loved it. And, yeah, actually, I'd like to see it again. And I would love to see, again, what Bogliano does next. So it's called Here Comes the Devil, and yeah, you can catch it now on iTunes, and the disc is forthcoming. Maybe we'll get the actual release info for the DVD Blu-ray out to you very shortly, but now you can see it on iTunes to rent.
right, so the next thing on the block here, the chopping block, is we're going to go into an analysis of Maniac, the original 1980 Bill Lustig, you know, classic slasher film, and the 2012 remake by Alexandre Aja.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the fuck you say his name.
Well, actually...
He wrote it, right?
Yes, he wrote it, Mr. High Tension himself, and Piranha.
Piranha 3D.
He's gone on to make some nice moves. But yeah, he wrote it, and he was actually co-written by, it was Aja, Lustig, and Levasseur is the other guy who co-wrote it, and one of the producers. Original director of Maniac, William Lustig, acted as an executive producer, and his name is in the credits as story by, from based on the movie by,
right.
You know, William Lustig.
And the actual, the director on the remake was this guy, Frank Halfoon.
Halfoon, that's right. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. But what's cool is the sort of synergy between the two films, because it's not like, you know, there was that rash of remakes that happened a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
where there was this vibe that these remakes were somehow going to replace the originals, like the thing with Friday the 13th,
mm-hmm.
you know, Love It or Hate It,
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, I actually liked the remake.
Yeah, I missed that one. I enjoyed the Friday the 13th remake. I enjoyed part one of the Halloween remake. I enjoyed
Halloween.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I also liked the Valentine's one.
Oh, My Bloody Valentine.
My Bloody Valentine, yeah. Yes. I enjoyed that one as well. And then you have the really crappy ones like Amityville Horror and your Prom Night and your Stepfathers.
Yep.
And then, you know, the real bottom of the barrel ones. But, yeah, this one will, I'm going to say, go down as one of the better ones.
Yeah, I would say, in my opinion, there's been three really notable remakes of classic horror films. And this is definitely number one on my list. Mm. And I would, in no particular order, I'd put the Dawn of the Dead remake.
Yes.
And also the My Bloody Valentine remake.
The Dawn of the Dead one put Zack Snyder on the map.
Absolutely.
Kicked off his career. Some of the purists didn't like that the zombies ran, but those purists liked everything else about the movie. So, I mean, there was, you know, it's a great horror movie, and it's a great, you know, first movie, absolutely. But getting back to Maniac, the original Maniac was one of the more controversial movies of the early 80s. Silent Night, Bloody Night, where... You know, critics really hated this movie. People were, you know, some people picketed this movie. They boycotted this movie. Well, because, I mean, it's a misogynistic film. Sure, absolutely. But I just think it's kind of a product of its time in a way.
I think I might have to go diverge a little bit with you there. Mm-hmm. Just because, yes, he does horrific things to women. However, he gets retribution at the end. I mean, he gets... You know.
Oh no! Well,
I mean,
absolutely.
It's not celebrating misogyny. Like,
no,
there's a lot of like negative shit in there, and that's the thing. A lot of people who pick at these films, I feel like they don't. They'll look at the surface, but they won't actually go deeper into it.
Right, you know, and then because he actually Frank Zito, his name.
Yeah. By the great,
amazing
Joe Spinell.
His reasoning. Was he was abused and molested by his mother.
Yeah.
Which, again, is not a reason to become a vile serial killer, but there's the justification there, you know, slight justification as to why someone may do something so horrible.
Yeah, he's been traumatized. I mean, he's not, you know, he's a reprehensible character. He's like this, you know, creepy, you know, late night, look behind your shoulder guy.
Yeah.
You know, like,
Joe Spinell literally helped create this archetype that we're even describing with this movie, pretty much.
You know, and so I mean, it's not like he's celebrated as this hero, there are films out there who actually celebrate the violence towards women, and they, you know, they sort of like, you know, just put a positive spin
on it.
And
what else sells the movie from its, you know, despicableness is his performance, yeah, and the music and the movie itself. It's well made. It's well shot. It's one of the first movies with very realistic 1980 effects by the young Tom Savini, who's in the movie, actually plays a victim in the movie. William Lustig was about 22 or 23 when he made this movie. New York guy. The whole movie is shot entirely in New York. It takes place in New York. Will Lustig has a cameo in the film. He is the hotel manager in the beginning.
Oh, you know, I didn't know
when
that.
Frank Zito with a lady of the night, they go up to rent a room. And he has one of my favorite lines in the movie is, "We'll be joining us for continental breakfast." That's Will Lustig's line in the movie. So yeah, I mean, he was really young when he made the movie. He had done some adult films he directed before this movie. But he was a big horror guy. He was a big 42nd Street guy. Loved the movies that were shown there, and went on to help define the movies that were shown there. He also, later on in life, went to work for Anchor Bay, who have, you know, helped put out many films by Fulci and Argento, and, you know, put out all the Evil Deads, and then left that company and started, 10, 12 years ago, Blue Underground, which is one of the finest companies for horror and indie and exploitation films there is. So he's an important guy, Will Lustig, and this is his first movie. And, yeah, he managed to get Joe Spinell, who it was shot in 80, came out in March of 81, actually. Joe Spinell, before this, had been in Rocky, had been in The Godfather.
Godfather, yeah. Cruising.
It was actually kind of a feather in his cap for a young director to get this movie. But he worked very closely with Lustig Spinell on this, where he has a writing credit.
Yeah.
And a screenplay credit.
That's
a story.
Like the story,
so,
yeah.
And he does quite a job. It's he's kind of unforgettable, really.
Spinell, I think, you know, one of the things I want to do here too is just point out that Spinell, Joe Spinell, is almost, I wouldn't say completely forgotten, but he's a more obscure actor that, you know, I feel like has never really gotten his just.
No, he has not.
You know, and he, you know, he's talented, you know, emotional, and. And very, you know, the story he had a part in writing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he actually was a smart guy. He was a partier. He liked to drink. He liked women. He liked drugs. Yeah. He was kind of a party animal, but he also had a completely different side to him as well. Some of this is discussed in the supplements.
On the Blu-ray.
On the 30th anniversary Blu-ray of Maniac from Blue Underground.
Yeah.
The Joe Spinell story, which is fantastic. It's an hour-long documentary. A very brief cameo by Mike Ness of Social Distortion.
Yes, that's right.
Which needs to be addressed. Yeah. Kind of inexplicable. It's in California in the late 80s, whatever.
There's some punks.
Yes, some punks outside.
They credit him, Mike Ness from Social
Distortion. Yes, Mike Ness is in this documentary. But yeah, I mean, it's just kind of he had kind of a crazy, cool life in a way. He died fairly young, in his late 50s.
Yeah, just from like living too hard.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
just going for it.
Exactly. You know? But I'll say this: time has been kind to the original Maniac.
Yes.
And here we are talking about it. There are Maniac shirts. If you Google Joe Spinell and Maniac, you get quite a bit. You get a lot of tons of people's. You used to get people with tattoos and homemade shirts and. It's kind of nice in a way that this movie, which was, I mean, I believe Siskel and Ebert ripped it to shreds.
Well, everyone ripped it to shreds.
I mean, this was not a welcome film. Yeah. People have revisited it, and people have written essays about it, and, you know, it's a time capsule of New York is also really what it is. It's a very cool, it shows the New York of 1980, which is fairly similar to the New York you see in Taxi Driver about four or five years earlier, to be honest.
Definitely.
New York is still pretty bad in 1980. And that definitely kind of shines through in the murkiness of the film.
Also on those DVD extras, the Blu-ray extras, they talk about the controversy a little bit, you know, and a lot of it was the actual poster. Even the poster was offensive.
Oh, yeah. I mean, to me, it's probably one of the greatest horror posters ever.
Yeah, it's like a guy with a scalp, a bloody knife, and a hard-on.
Yes, and the funny thing is, I myself, maybe only less than 10, 12 years ago, never fully realized that the man literally has an erection in his jeans on the cover.
Yeah, I never realized until recently.
Yeah, I was a young kid in the early video days, and when we first got a VCR and started joining 50 million rental places in the neighborhood, which my dad liked to do, one of them had this tremendous Maniac poster in it. And I was horrified and fascinated of this poster. I warned you not to go out tonight with a bloody knife and a scalp and a dude in jeans and like a leather jacket. I was like, what the hell is that? Like, I was scared.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see the movie so bad.
Yeah, it was effective, man. It was one of the best.
It's, yeah, yeah. They don't make posters like that anymore. They just take people's faces and throw them on the poster. That's what they do.
What I thought was interesting is also the Rona Barrett, her analysis of the whole thing on the Blu-ray, mm-hmm. Controversy, extra, where they were talking about the appeal of these slasher films, which is, there's like a quote in there for it's like, thrill-seeking teenagers and minorities are attracted to it. And then she kind of went into this like pretty racist.
Minorities.
She kind of went into this pretty racist, tirade to get.
Wow.
That, oh, yeah, like only, blacks and Hispanics are into like
what she kind of meant by that. I'm gonna say is 42nd Street was frequented by gang members, drug dealers, thuggy types, and these people did love horror movies. And maybe I'm gonna say that's probably what she was kind of getting at with that little statement right there, because now statistically it's obviously way more than those types of people liking horror movies. And women in the amount of women in general going to see horror movies has exploded, apparently. And I would say, as someone who goes to a few different horror conventions a year, the amount of women going to the horror conventions has exploded. So,
yeah.
You know.
But also, you're talking about women getting involved and going to horror films. The horror film of today, even mm-hmm. The most extreme horror movies versus the horror films of the late 70s and the 80s, that was like the punk rock of horror.
Right.
That was like the raw...
everything was new,
brutal.
There was no rules, right?
Yeah. But now, even 30 years later, it's like there's a layer of sort of sophistication, and mm-hmm. There's been a couple different rounds of people making films.
Right. Women are still getting tortured and killed, but women are also the survivors,
yeah.
And they're the winner. Like, they're the winners now in
yeah.
the movie. They're the
yeah.
They saved the day, pretty much.
But, the women were the winners. Well, actually,
yeah,
no. But that was more of a
right.
But that
Halloween,
was,
yes. There's emphasis, yes. But
yeah.
For the more kind of gritty, cheaper, it might not have always been the case for certain movies. Women did not always come out on top in horror, but obviously now it's a completely different world.
Yeah. But that's time capsule, classic horror film.
Yeah.
The remake, originally.
Mm-hmm.
I was very dubious about
Elijah
Wood.
I mean, 2-3 years ago, first hearing about it, because Elijah Wood, who plays the modern Frank Zito in the remake, was attached to the movie from pretty early on. And that alone was shocking to hear, coming off of Lord of the Rings
yeah.
the trilogy.
Yep.
Into
Frodo.
Maniac. Yeah, of all the horror movies of the 80s. Wow. I mean, it was very surprising to hear.
Yeah, because I couldn't reconcile, the Joe Spinell's Frank Zito
mm-hmm.
with Elijah Wood's Frank Zito, and
right.
originally I just dismissed the whole thing, and I was like, "This is never going to work. How could this possibly work?" Then I found out that Aja was involved in
right.
this thing, and
that it takes place not in New York and not in the 80s, 70s. It takes place today, and it's in L.A. And it's like, well, they're doing something different here.
It added a different spin to it. The same storyline is basically intact. The name is still intact.
Mm-hmm.
They reference Joe Spinell's...
Several times in the movie, correct.
Yeah, yes. Like that visage of this, greasy, long-haired creep,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. with like acne scars,
Yes, there's a very funny scene in the movie where Elijah Wood is on the internet and he meets a girl... for the first time in a bar, and they did exchange pictures, but she didn't believe that that's what he actually looked like. And when she sees that that is what he looks like, she goes, "I thought you would look different." And he's like, "How did you think I looked?" And he goes, And she goes, I thought you'd have long, greasy hair, pockmarked skin, and a mustache, or something like that. Just basically Joe Spinell, she basically was describing. So that was kind of a nice little nod to Joe Spinell.
So, you know, it was sort of with I tried to have an open mind. You know, I went into this thing like, okay, you know, Aja's doing it. You know, anything can happen, man. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just like, this could be good, or it could completely suck. So, but I got to say, man, I was thoroughly satisfied by it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, right from the start, it has, worth mentioning, the soundtrack in the original is pretty great and creepy in itself. Jay Chataway did the score, and it is very moody, dark, kind of emotional music that sticks with you. For the modern-day remake, we get what I call, it's like new 80s synth music.
Yeah. Yep.
Where it's new music, but it totally could have been in the original in a way. Right.
Yeah.
It has that vibe to it that is like, wow, this sounds old but new. And it is done by Rob. First name. Rob, who did the soundtrack. And the soundtrack is fantastic, actually. It's, I mean, it's somewhat akin to the Beyond the Black Rainbow kind of music,
man.
Where it's like...
Yeah.
It just sounds like, you know, the Tangerine Dream, maybe a little goblin-y, but more the straight synth-y, proggy goblin, not the rocked-out goblin.
Yeah.
It's just this very cool, moody music that fits a very dark, modern L.A. very well.
Yeah. Also, there's the Q Lazarus song, Goodbye Horses, which, you know, one of the... ladies was dancing to.
Yes.
You know, another horror reference. That's the thing about modern horror is there's oftentimes tastelessly referencing older films.
Right.
But in this case, tastefully referencing older films.
Yeah, a couple of times, which is
very
nice.
Referencing its original by, like, describing Joe Spinell.
Mm-hmm.
And then also using, you know, the Goodbye Horses, Q Lazarus track from... You know, the Silence of the Lambs.
Yes, yes. That was a nice surprise, actually.
Yeah.
That was very nice.
Yeah. I'm like, you know, some little slutty chick putting on some music, you know, dance around, you know. But yeah, that was, you know, so far everything's aces, you know.
And another thing is they decided, the director of this movie decided that we will not really see the new Frank. It's a POV movie where we see everything he sees, except for when he is in a mirror in a reflection. That's the only time you see him, actually, Elijah Wood. Which, again, sounded really weird to read about that, I remember.
Yeah.
Like, what are they doing? Like, but you see the movie and it works very nicely.
He made his own movie, you know what I mean? And that's what I like about it. It wasn't just like, okay, let's like slap together some, you know, some elements from the original. Mm-hmm. Let's get some, like, you know, really attractive people to be in the movie. You know?
Right.
Because, you know, Elijah Wood, you know, he actually looked like this, like, creepy...
Yes.
You know...
He transformed. I mean, he's short. He's got a young face. I mean, Elijah Wood looks like a nice guy, in essence. He does. He doesn't look like a creep guy. Yet, he managed to look pretty creepy in this movie, actually.
He looked really creepy.
Grew his hair out a little more. Grew a very bizarre mustache.
Yep. Pale.
Very pale. And just, you know, psychotic acting, and he did a great job.
Yeah, I think he pulled it off completely, and it actually changed my whole idea about him as an actor because, you know, you're used to seeing him as a likable guy, mm-hmm. you know, except for Sin City, where he played a psychopath.
Yes, it's funny. A lot of people, you know, don't realize that his very dark turn in that movie 8-9 years ago. And he did quite well with that, and so it wasn't so much a shock to see him do this, because as it turns out, he actually is a very big horror fan himself, and now has plans to produce and be involved in new horror movies, I've read.
Oh, cool.
Another thing worth mentioning is in the original, the female lead is played by the amazing Caroline Monroe of James Bond films and Sinbad films, and just... To me, one of the best-looking chicks of the 70s. I've always had a thing for Caroline Monroe. I've met her like 3 times. Nice as hell. I believe she has a place in Manhattan, I think. And I think I've seen her on the street once. Like,
really?
Yes, this was about 8-9 years ago. I saw Caroline Monroe crossing the street, actually.
The original.
Oh, yeah.
But the original, you know. Originally, the role was supposed to be played by Daria Nicolodi.
Yes, that is true, yeah. But you know what? It works way better with Caroline Monroe.
Yeah.
And the very another thing worth noting is not, well, she's great in the movie, but they have chemistry in the movie.
Yeah.
Joe Spinell and her, worlds apart, you know. Beautiful British girl, scuzzy New York guy, have a very interesting chemistry in the movie.
See, but that's the thing, man, because, you know, in the film, like, you know, when you think about Joe, the Frank Zito character.
He's nuts, but he can be charming.
Because
he charms her.
Yeah, because there's that damage that comes to the front. There's almost like a two-split personality going on.
Absolutely.
Where there's like the Joe Spinell, or I'm sorry, the Frank Zito personality, which should have been dominant had he not had a, you know, prostitute mother. You know what I'm saying?
No, actually, yeah.
And then there's like the sort of twisted version of himself, which when he gets close to people comes to the forefront.
Right.
But also the thing that I always got a kick out of is the fact that like he was like, oh, I am an artist, you know, he's like a painter.
Yeah, he just kind of rattled off what he did there, and she just believed it.
She just bought it.
Yeah. No problem.
I agree.
I mean, yeah,
sure, you're a painter.
He came off with some swagger, I guess you would say. He came off like, I'm interested in photography, you're a photographer, blah, blah, blah. Like, she bought it. Like, you know, it's kind of interesting. Meanwhile, he's chopping up women. It's like unbelievable.
Cutting their hair off. You know?
And in the remake, we have another beautiful woman playing Anna, only this time it's a blonde.
French lady.
A blonde French girl. And again, she sees the other side of Elijah Wood's character. And Elijah Wood is giving her his best, you know, putting on his best face.
But the sort of setting for the two of them meeting is a little bit more realistic, in my opinion.
Yes.
You know, Elijah Wood is like, you know, some quirky, you know, mannequin restoration
specialist.
He's a mannequin,
right, yes, that's, we have to mention,
you know,
that that's
what
he does.
And she's a fashion photographer, and she was, you know, taking photographs on the street, and, you know, noticed his shop,
and she was interested in mannequins for a shoot. And
yeah, so there was a little bit more of like a logic, can follow that logic.
In the original, we have to say, Joe Spinell's creeping in the park during the daytime and just sees the beautiful Caroline Monroe shooting pictures in the park, and she just happens to be shooting pictures of him, and he, while she's not looking, takes a peek at her bag and sees her 17th Street apartment tag, you know, Manhattan apartment, and just shows up at her house one day.
Yeah. That's pretty far-fetched, too.
Yeah. So, you know. Suspension of disbelief.
Actually, I think the photograph, when she saw him hanging out in the park, wasn't he like hassling like some kids?
Yes, he was about to.
And she like
there was kids. Yeah, he was. Oh, it was. Yeah, it was a horrible moment, right?
Yeah.
But you know, you get to pick up Caroline Monroe. It's not a bad day for you.
Yeah.
For Frank Zito, right?
But Elijah's Frank though is a little bit more. You know, he's like a crafty, like artsy.
Yeah.
Sort of
no
guy,
swag. You know? No like.
You know, like.
No extreme charm, but just. It's a little something.
Say introverted,
right?
You know, sort of uncomfortable. You know, modern guy,
right?
You know,
exactly.
Sort of artsy, and you know, he was like hiding behind his door, and you know, if you want to know if you could help her, you know, he opens up the door, and there she is. And but yeah, it was that interaction I found to be a lot more believable, and his sort of discomfort around her and trying to, you know, get assimilated into the fashion photography world when she goes to that party,
right,
and, you know, being completely out of place with that whole thing.
And they also kept the Frank backstory intact for this one as well. They go a little further in this. In the original, it is the abuse is implied through these voices. You don't see, there's no flashback of actual physical actors in the original. There's only an audio flashback of his mother, him whining and crying to his mother. His mother kind of abusing him, and him talking about all the men that have come to the house. In the new one, it ups the creepiness a little, where it actually shows the mom having sex
Two guys.
Yes.
Doing some cocaine.
Doing like, and then there's the instance of the mom touching him as a boy, which they don't. Again, they don't show a lot, but they show enough to clearly spell out what the hell's going on, which puts it over the original.
Yeah. But you know, all in all, like very, very impressive entry into the remake.
Oh, absolutely. If you were a fan of the original and had tons of reservations about the remake, I would suggest putting them to the side and checking out the remake. Absolutely.
Also, what's missing is that in the ending of the original too, there's that sort of typical 1980s ending, you know, where Frank opens his eyes after he's been like, you know,
right, the surprise gotcha, you know, is he dead, is he alive?
Yeah, because there were supposed to be like a sequel to that.
Yeah, that's it. That's a whole story in itself. There was plans for a sequel that never came to fruition, actually. I forget what the title was going to be, actually.
Yeah, they talk about it on the Blu-ray.
Right. Yeah, I mean, because Joe Spinell actually, you know, was his character, Frank Zito. So, you know, he would have had the freedom to do that had he, you know, not fallen on even harder times in the post-Maniac landscape and then, of course, passed away.
But he had some success after that film, though, like in his career.
Yeah. I believe Cruisin' is right in the same year, 81. I believe it's right literally around the same time as that. And in the documentary, it actually shows him he was doing stand-up for a moment, too, before he did movies. He was kind of like a Renaissance man, you know? Acting, producing, writing, stand-up, you know?
What's interesting to touch on, too, is Spinell's sort of, you know, I wouldn't say it was unhealthy, but he had a very peculiar relationship with his mother, too.
Yes,
you know,
right.
Which might have sort of...
He was a mom. He was an adult mama's boy.
Yeah.
He was. And another cool thing about him is that he was tight with Sylvester Stallone and was loaning a very young Sylvester Stallone money to get by. A few people back up the story that this is true.
Yeah.
And then after Rocky 1 and, you know, 2, he had a bit of a falling out with Rocky. And I guess, according to him, the bigger Sylvester Stallone got, his people didn't want him mingling with the old people. And, you know, these things happen. Of course, Sylvester Stallone went on to become a tremendous star and, you know, probably said goodbye to some of the old crew. And Spinell was probably some of the old crew.
Yeah. That's pretty mind-blowing if you think
yes,
about it.
Yes, it is, though, yeah. I mean,
a young Sylvester Stallone was, like, taken under the wing of Joe Spinell.
Yes, that is very interesting indeed. Because, Godfather had already happened, and he was, you know, he had a cool little role in that saga. You know, remember him on the stand?
He
was talking to the feds, you know?
Yeah, he was in 1 and 2.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, you know, and he plays, he has a minor role in Cruisin'. As a dirty cop.
Yeah, dirty cop.
Very convincing, again.
Yeah. Cruising is something we should talk about at some point, because that's, you know, that's an interesting film for a number of reasons. Number one, it's an American giallo, basically.
Yes.
Me and you have talked about
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. A lot of the elements of the giallo films of the 70s and early 80s are in this movie, and that we could, you know, it's definitely something that can be discussed at length. But also, it's another time capsule movie of New York, back in the day, New York of 80, 81, the sleazier, you know, completely different, more crime-ridden New York.
And also, it was another film that had a lot of controversy around its release, too, you know, back in the day it came out.
Because it's a depiction of the gay community at the time, and which is kind of weird because, well, according to a lot of people, that type of stuff was going on in the gay community at the time. So, but I think what the gay community was upset about was the whole we're serial killing murderers and drug. You know, there were different things about it. Exactly,
maybe just representing one particular aspect
of their
community.
Exactly. But it's the movie that Al Pacino wants us all to forget. Basically,
he's not into that.
He's softened up on it, but for a very long time he didn't acknowledge it, didn't want to talk about it.
I thought he was great in that movie.
That's the thing. He was great in it, and I think again, it's one of those movies where time and distance have been more kind to it, because now I read these far better reviews of that movie than in the original reviews that you read, which were, you know, they killed it.
Yeah, that movie is something you can watch. It's like timeless, in my opinion. Like mm-hmm. that movie, you can pick it up any year and watch it, and it's still great.
And another great, great soundtrack. The Germs are on it, and just these kind of really interesting New York-centric bands that wound up on the soundtrack and probably disappeared off the face of the earth. Kind of like old, kind of punk, kind of new mm-hmm. wave kind of stuff on it. That is actually really, really good music.
Yeah. So you saw Goblin recently?
Yes, I did. funny story is, over the summer, it was announced that Goblin was coming to do a tour, and they're playing New York, and I bought my tickets in July or August for an October show, something I never do, by the way. I never do that. I never buy something that far in advance. And lo and behold, the show came and went, and I missed it. it was at Webster Hall, because I thought it was the next night, and it was the night before, and blah, blah, blah. I was really pissed and upset, but it was so successful that they added a second leg. And I found this out about 2 weeks after that, an original show. And, they played Le Poison Rouge instead of Webster Hall for the second time. But what was really interesting about their second leg was that it was missing Claudio Simonetti, one of the more key figures of the group, and the person who kind of comes to mind, really, with the visibility of the group when you think about them. However, he was not a part of the second leg of the U.S. tour.
I was unaware of that.
Whatever reason, he was not. But two more original members were for the second leg.
Huh.
So if you went to the Le Poison Rouge show, you got four original Goblin members instead of two that took place at the Webster Hall show.
How big of a place is that Poisson Rouge?
I've
never been there.
Okay, it's smaller than, say, the main room of Webster Hall, but it's bigger than the downstairs room of Webster Hall. So kind of the midway. It's
okay.
Good size. Good size. Yeah. Pretty decent sound. Years ago, when it was called something else, I saw Typo Negative there. I saw The Misfits there. And I saw one other show. I can't think of it right now. But they had some decent shows there back in the day. It's around the corner from, you know, Generation Records in the Village over there. But, it was really something. They kicked it off with a lot of songs from a 2005 CD they had made, again, without Simonetti, called Back to the Goblin. And some of their more, like, obscure songs. They have many albums, aside from the key soundtracks to, like, Tenebrae and Deep Red and Suspiria and Dawn of the Dead. So it was like, you know, first we're going to play those songs, and then we're going to end it with all the home runs. So it was pretty long set, actually. The coolest thing about it, though, was to, like, I mean, it's one thing to hear them in your headphones all the time, and I've really been listening to them almost about 15 years ago. I got really into them, and I just never in a million years thought they would tour. I mean, you know, these guys in their 60s, and, you know, 15 years ago, there was not the scene for Goblin that exists now. It just was not. If you were a fan of theirs, you were a horror maniac freak, you know, or a prog music freak.
You were a necromaniac.
You were a true necromaniac, exactly. Now, the DVD explosion is really what put Argento and Fulci and many others over the top, really. And it's kind of been a great thing in a lot of ways because it put Goblin over the top.
Do you remember back before DVDs, there was those weird video bootleg clubs?
Yes.
Those VHS, like, I can't remember the names of some of them.
Well, some of them had, like order forms in the mail, and, you know, they were guys with, I don't know, hundreds and thousands of VHS tapes, probably multiple VHS systems, and, you know, their job or second job was dubbing tapes in real time.
And they would talk, it was all real time. So it was, the claim was that they were all transferred from, you know,
the original, and, it was crazy. I mean,
that's how I first got a lot of those films. Was like,
absolutely,
you know, I don't know how that's legal though. It's basically
it's total pirate. It was completely illegal.
But I don't know how it even existed. Well, you know, I guess back in the '90s, you can, things like that can slip under the radar.
Right, right.
Know, nowadays, forget
but,
about
you know, DVD killed the VHS, but DVD saved the horror movie. I mean, really, it gave people new careers. You know, Argento was always pretty popular. I mean, the serious horror person or the serious European horror, knew him. And Fangoria gave him a lot of, you know, coverage, and his movies made their way into America, but a good chunk of them didn't. And a good chunk of Goblin's music was all imports. In the late 90s, this CD also, you know, they benefit from CDs as well, obviously, Goblin. But, yeah, people would see these movies and fall in love with the music. In some cases, falling in love with the music more than the movie. You know, because Argento's movies, let's face it, are not for everybody.
No.
Some people may not like Deep Red, but they'll love that theme song, or they'll think, you know, Suspiria is overrated, which I hate when people say that. But they're like, yeah, that music was cool, though, you know, so. But,
and also, there's different Argento films that mm-hmm. are like some, I don't like all of his movies, honestly, mm-hmm. but some I like and some of them I.
Right, right.
I wouldn't say I dislike any of his films, but some I think are better than others, obviously, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
his recent stuff is not so great.
Yeah, that's a show in itself, too. Going one by one with the Argento movies. That'd be quite a show. But yeah, I mean, you know, people want to hear those songs, and getting the chance to hear them live, like the theme from Dawn of the Dead live, yeah. like their version, their music was amazing, and everything just sounded like perfect. You know, I mean, these are musicians who were real musicians, you know,
yeah,
like
definitely.
Lifelong lifer musicians who can play bass, guitar, keyboards. I mean. It was like a dream almost, you know. They had some nice merchandise. I got a shirt, of course I did.
Damn. I fucked up completely. In
there was the one thing of note is there's the 12-inch that was making the rounds the first leg of the tour, which they said they only made 500 of, and red vinyl, you know. I bought mine like an idiot on eBay for $50. There's no way in hell they made 500 of these records. These records are everywhere, and they're $20 everywhere. Of course, this really happened after I spent my $50 on the record, and I have no idea how many they made, but it's way more than 500. They had tons at the show. The record is every record store I've been in the past 3 months has had the record. It's in distros. I mean, they made 5,000.
But are they the red vinyl?
Yes, that's the other thing. Yes, they are. So who knows? Maybe the plan was to make 500, and it sold like immediately.
Yeah.
And then they had to have repressed this thing. It's everywhere. So, but yeah, I got a cool shirt. I don't know. I mean, I just feel like I was bummed out that I missed that first show so much, but seeing the second show was great. I mean, you know.
There's been talk of them doing another tour.
Yes, which I would never say. I mean, I wouldn't put it past them.
Yeah,
they've all the shows have been either sold out or close to it, and you know it's a supply and demand. You know, I mean, why not? Like we caught Black Sabbath last August, and a lot of people I think were under the impression of this is going to be it. This is going to be it. No, they're coming back.
Yeah, they did a great job too. They did. Yeah. They were awesome. Oh, yeah. They sounded great. You know.
I think when it comes to the older groups or the more special groups, unless they're announcing, no, this is a final tour, they'll do it till they can't do it anymore. I mean, that's what I would do. That's what Leonard Cohen is doing. I mean, you don't hear him saying anything's a final anything. It's like, if I'm here, I'm doing it, you know?
Yeah. No, that's good.
And seeing him last year, the guy was on his knee. The guy was moving around. He was singing like a 30-something. I mean, it was like a crazy, you know? Who gets down on both knees and sings into the microphone in their 70s and gets back up and like, that was some awesome, that was amazing to see that.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Hey, so do you have any news about the Beyond the Black Rainbow soundtrack at all? Do you know anything about that?
You know what?
There
is talk about it, but it's funny. One of my favorite companies, and obviously quite a few other people's favorite companies for the soundtrack vinyls, Mondo Tees, the last thing they put out was the Halloween soundtrack on vinyl, which looks beautiful. I got my orange copy. But they haven't put anything else out. Like, they're due for a new vinyl, I heard that they're doing, like, I can't really confirm that they're doing it. I don't even know what they're doing next.
Huh.
So, you know, of course, you'll get the text the minute I hear about it.
Someone told me that Death Wall's one's putting it out.
Okay, see, that's the thing. They're snatching up quite a bit, too.
Yeah.
I'm hearing that I think Death Waltz is doing Friday the 13th, which has been the vinyl. There's only, I believe, one pressing of the Friday the 13th vinyl, and it has that kind of cool 3D cover. It goes for, you know, a lot of money. And, man, Manfredi, the soundtrack is awesome. The music in that movie is awesome. So hopefully that comes out. Be nice if there was a hardware vinyl. That would be nice.
Yeah,
like a big hardware fans.
Yeah. The hardware of the film.
Yes, but, yep. Yes, that would be very cool. But we could just speak a little bit about the vinyl horror explosion. Death Waltz, Mondo are doing quite well with these. Almost everything seems to be selling out or coming close to it. Of note, Mondo's first release was Maniac. Was their first vinyl release 2 years ago. They only made 500. That thing goes for a fortune. I got one. And then they did the remake vinyl, which also sold out. I have one of those as well. So,
I like to have a digital copy of that soundtrack.
I could hook you up with the metal tin of Anchor Bay came with the CD soundtrack.
Oh, Maniac. Really?
It's a shaped disc. It can only go into a CD player that has the spindle.
Right,
exactly. Right.
Wow.
But I believe I was able to put... I don't think I was able to put my computer. But maybe I was. I can't remember. But anyway, yeah, I can get that to you. That's actually a cool soundtrack. Aside from being able to get almost all major pop releases on vinyl, they're banging out great old horror movies on vinyl, you know, soundtracks. So I'm all for it. I think it's cool, you know? I mean, I'll buy them all.
Yeah.
You know, I want there to be a Warriors reissue. I mean, I don't think that's happening though. I haven't heard any talk about that. I like that soundtrack. That would be nice.
Yeah. So, what are your thoughts on the new The Walking Dead? Like, what it's become? Well, there's a lot of conflicted.
It's amazing. I mean, started reading the comic around 2005, 2006, about 3 years into its initial run. And I still read it. I love it.
I think it's great. I think the comic book's great still.
The comic book is great. The TV show, people complained that it was deviating too much from the comic, but if you really think about it, if it was the comic, you'd know what was happening every turn, and nobody wants that.
I don't want that.
And then other people are saying that it's not paced right, or it's either too slow, or they're killing off the wrong people, or... There's lots of complaints, but at the end of the day, the viewers are there. They haven't lost any viewers. They've gained viewers with each finale and each premiere. I mean, it is pretty amazing. The negative side, it's created a legion of horror posers. That's the negative side.
I agree. Yeah. Yep.
It's a legion of zombie experts.
It's like false black metal.
Right. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, totally.
It's created the fake horror fan.
Yeah.
Some of these people, it's the only horror they do watch, which is it's amazing. It's The Walking Dead. I just like The Walking Dead. You know, I mean, it's just like, wow, you know.
Yeah.
Like, and of course, people who love horror are not going to want to hear that. You know, it's amazing. It's a violent show. It's a dark show. Yet it has struck a chord with millions of people. And it's not just America. It's a world show.
Yeah.
It's all over the world, actually. And it has made Robert Kirkman a very wealthy man. So, but I'll say this, success has not ruined that comic. It's still a very good comic. His heart, I believe, is still in that comic. If that had kind of shit the bed, I think I'd be a very unhappy camper, and I'd be really kind of dissing on him. But I have to say, I've met him at conventions, like twice, briefly, but... The guy seems like a very normal, down-to-earth, nice guy, pretty egoless kind of guy, and I don't know. I can't say too many bad things about Robert Kirk.
Yeah, I think I think the TV show is like his day job, and the comic is like his passion.
Yeah, so. Yeah. It seems that that's what it's become.
Because the comic is still pushing strong, man. That's powerful stuff.
And it takes risks, and it has its own really messed up killings. And
oh, yeah.
It's just like you really are on the edge of your seat. It's akin to the last two, three seasons of Breaking Bad, where it's like you're getting to the mid end of the comic, and you're like, what's going to happen?
Yeah.
It's like that show. It's like you never knew what the hell was going to happen.
Yeah, the comic is still evolving and changing, mm-hmm. and I just recently, you know, I reread some of the earlier ones, and I can see I'm like, wow, this is like a really evolving, mm-hmm. morphing sort of storyline, and it's a very rich. There's characters that if you forgot about that mm-hmm. existed. And, you know, the TV show, I think, is interesting. It's good. I still come back and watch it.
I'm sticking around, yeah.
You know, I'm going to watch it till the last episode, man.
I don't think it's terrible. I don't think it's bad. It's just, I have my good days with him bad. There's one storyline I really hope the TV show tackles is the one about the human cannibals.
Yeah.
Which is my favorite story arc in the Walking Dead comic. And, wow, I mean, I think they totally could put it on
totally.
The show.
I think they're probably destined to do that.
Yeah,
you know?
It's too good a storyline to ignore, where the, you know, the problem isn't so much the zombies in this story arc. It's these really fucked up other survivors that hunt the humans to eat them. So it's pretty wild. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's pretty great.
And I think that the show is like significant in like a sort of cultural way too.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
You know, as far as like one of, you know how people talk about The Sopranos, like sort of put TV in a different place. Mm-hmm. I feel like The Walking Dead is taking like horror and like, you know.
Oh, absolutely. It's
put that like in like a legitimate television setting.
There'd be no American Horror Story without Walking Dead. You would not have, you know, Preacher in development again without The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
You would not have, I mean, and it's helping the comics thing, too. The more adult comics. Sandman it looks like it may happen. I mean, it's just all these things might be happening. I'm putting Walking Dead as a very big cause for that, you know?
So there's talks about a new Preacher thing, like a series, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
AMC has the rights right now. Yeah.
So that's the right people that should
went,
be
HBO had the HBO had it for several years. They didn't do anything with it. Nothing happened with it. It apparently is in the hands of AMC now.
That's great.
I mean, wow, shit, that would be amazing. It would be amazing. And Sandman is off the TV discussion. It's in the movie discussion, and it's Joseph Gordon-Levitt apparently has a hand in it. So
Sandman could work as a film.
Yeah, as long as it's. It has to be a series of films. Can't just be one film.
Yeah, but you know? But Preacher needs to be like a TV show.
Yes.
A series with like a beginning and an end.
And I think TV is ready for it, and especially cable TV.
Yeah.
We've seen the envelope get pushed pretty damn far on AMC. I think maybe a few things would have to be scaled back, but not all that much.
And especially like with the iTunes trip now, because that's how I watch TV. Like I don't have cable or any kind of like, you know, legitimate
if
TV.
If you have
set
iTunes
set up
streaming to your TV along with Netflix and along with, I don't know, a few of the other streaming whatever services, you kind of, and some patience, you kind of don't need that TV in that sense.
Yeah, because I usually, you know, I subscribe to, you know, the iTunes subscriptions with a couple of shows. And, you know, you can download the next day.
Mm-hmm.
I can live with that.
Yeah.
You know. Could definitely live with that.
It's pretty cool. I mean, unless, you know, I understand certain network shows though. You can't watch them anywhere else other than I forget which one of the big three networks.
Yeah, I don't
I forget
recall.
Which one. Yeah, yeah. It's probably one of the ones I don't watch anyway, but I forget which one doesn't like can't watch them except for on TV. It's kind of weird.
Cuz I know HBO had like when you know, for Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
It was you could download the next day,
right?
Mm-hmm. But you know, True Detective is not available on iTunes.
Really?
It's only I watch it on HBO Go.
Right.
So I have like, you know, so I'm using someone's code.
Oh yes, I'll pretend I didn't hear that.
You know, don't rat on me.
Oh, I won't. Don't worry.
But you know that True Detective.
It's great.
That's
so
like,
great. If you're a horror fan, watch True Detective.
Because, you know, it's like there still could be like a supernatural element to
it. Oh, yeah. The story is not finished. It's 8 parts. I wish it was 10.
Yeah.
They're only up to the 3rd. The 4th is coming this weekend. True Detective, check it out. It's not just crime. It definitely has a horror bent. It has a very dark bent. It's a couple different genres thrown together. I think it's fantastic.
Like I don't think it'll necessarily go the supernatural route, but it'll go like the creepy Silence of the Lambs, serial murder.
There's a cult killer on the loose.
Yeah.
And for some people, that right there
makes it a horror film.
It makes it horror, and it also, whether or not it reaches supernatural elements in the kill, like, you know what I'm saying, it's kind of yet to be determined, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Who knows how they're going to explain what's been going on?
It's enough of a horror film, a horror series for me to like be like, it's a horror series. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's got enough of those elements in it. You
yeah.
know? It's unfolding. So it's a slow burner.
Yes.
Man, you know, and I love that.
You have no idea what's going to happen. It has the Breaking Bad moments of just like, what the hell's going to happen?
But you know
what's possibly going to happen. Yeah.
You know the ending is going to be fucking
brutal.
Intense.
Yes.
Because my understanding is that these seasons are they stand alone. Mm-hmm. There's no continuity between
right.
seasons.
And the only continuity is that they're all detective, murder,
yeah, crime.
Mystery, crime, mysteries.
Yeah.
Which, come on, right there. You have the two of us right there. I mean, we're there for this
show.
That's so many people I know.
That's
that
the second cousin of like the horror genre.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you and I can go on and on about like crime.
Exactly. And, I mean, you know, that's why I always got a kick out of like SVU.
Yeah.
It's whatever, it's a crime TV major network, but no, it's brutal. The show's kind of brutal. It's really dark, and it's not necessarily horror, but it borders on horrific reality shit. You know what I'm saying? Like multiple rapes and murders and sex crime. I mean, it has very rough moments. SVU.
Well, also, I mean, really, the reality is that a lot of these films that we're considering horror movies, like even Maniac, is not. There's nothing occult or supernatural.
No,
about it.
It's man-made. You know, horror. It's believable. It's
totally believable.
Right. There were horrible serial killers out there doing these terrible things. So, yeah, it has the believability factor. You know.
Well, like the serial killer genre is really a separate genre that
mm-hmm.
is like in between horror and true crime style, like noir.
Yeah.
You know, depending on how it's, I think mainly it's the writing and how the characters are presented
mm-hmm.
that really differentiates those two like genres.
It's funny though. I've said this before. I'll say it again. The last 5 years, 6 years have been a TV renaissance. I think it has been the best time for television ever, in my opinion, with what's been going on HBO and AMC and Showtime, and we're coming to the end of an era because, well, you know, Dexter is over.
Mm-hmm.
Boardwalk Empire is ending this year. True Blood's ending this year. Mad Men's ending this year. Breaking Bad ended last year. We are coming to the end of an era. And I'm a TV guy, obviously, for these type of shows. And I just think that the groundwork for more greatness is there. And I hope that a Preacher happens. I hope True Detective just gets better and better. And I just hope that the future is wide open, you know, in these places, because it's quite a few shows I just rattled off that are in.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. But there are definitely, you know, there's a lot of stuff brewing, though. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I mean, love it or hate it, American Horror Story is still like a...
No, that's... Good. Yeah, it's not going anywhere. I mean, I don't like it as much as everybody else does, but... It does very well.
It pushes the envelope, too.
No, it does. It does.
You know, it's like they take chances with subjects, and I think that, you know, I like it. You know, the
mm-hmm.
third season, I started off strong, kind of like withered a little bit, but in general, the concept behind it, I think, is good for all three seasons, and they, for a TV show, it's like really pushing in different directions.
No, it's brutal. If I couldn't fathom this being on television as a young man, you know, as a kid. I mean, it's just, the landscape is completely different. So, you know, much like with the superhero movies, if they made these superhero movies 20 years ago, they would have been terrible. They're great now because of technology is great now.
And also you have real legitimate actors
yes,
involved now.
Like,
you got, like, you know.
wanting to do these movies, and you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's just a different world.
So is there any truth to that rumor about Johnny Depp playing Doctor Strange?
Well, there was as much truth to it as that day allowed, and then for the next day to allow John Hamm into the mix. Yeah, so there's been no further word on that, to be honest. Right now, Marvel and DC are plotting these strategies against each other to see what's going to be happening in 2015 and 2016. It's pretty crazy. Superman, Batman has been pushed back a whole other year, which I think is a good idea. This movie needs to be special and great.
Yeah.
And DC needs it to be special and great. As great as Man of Steel did, and I liked it, Iron Man 3 and Avengers did way better. So DC is like, you know what? Next year is rushing this thing. We're pulling back. This is a 2016 movie.
Now that's the Ben Affleck. Batman.
Superman, Batman. And it's gonna have Wonder Woman in it. And it's gonna have Flash. It's like I can see the hesitation of rushing this movie.
Who's playing Wonder Woman?
Oh, Gal Gadot. Oh, I'd have to look it up.
Who the fuck is that?
But they announced her. Yeah, she had a small role in the last two Fast and Furious movies. She's very pretty. She has dark hair, but she does not have blue eyes. And she is not as built as Wonder Woman. She's a little too thin.
No, they'll get her on a kettlebell.
No, if you put some heels on her and you make her gain about 15 pounds.
Muscle.
She's a good-looking woman. When you see her, you'll be like, okay. Does she look like Linda Carter in 1978? No, because no one does. But she's an attractive woman, and we'll see what she does.
I wasn't unaware that.
Yeah, no, they picked her a few weeks back, Mike.
Okay. Yeah. And where was I?
I don't know. You missed out on it. That damn Yahoo News that opens up on my computer. You get to see the world.
Well, that wraps up our first episode.
First
man.
Necromaniacs. Yes, it was a good one.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, the tangents, well, you can forgive the tangents.
That's all part of the trip, man.
It's part of the trip, and at least it's within the world of what we feel the listener is interested in.
Yeah. Well, at least it's what me and you want to talk about.
Or, yeah, to be honest, it's what me and you just want to talk about. But, yeah, I mean, we're musicians, and we're in the music scene, but we love movies, and particularly horror movies, and love talking about horror movies, so... You know, if you're checking this out because of you know, Mike Hill's music, and it just so happens that you love horror movies as well, then welcome aboard.
Hell yeah. Alrighty. Have a good night.
See you next time.